It used to be that if you wanted to watch sex in the movies, you had to put on clothes. You would have to find a place that was showing so-called adult movies, and you had to sit in the dark with a bunch of strangers. This was the 1970s, when Deep Throat and The Devil in Miss Jones, that's the devil in Miss Jones, and Behind the Green Door were hits. But then in the 1980s, the VCR comes along and the adult film industry shifted production to home video and Hollywood freaked out. And I have a theory. They had to think of something that would keep people coming to theaters. So they figured, let's just take the sex and build a whole plot around it and we'll basically turn it into a genre. And that genre winds up being called the erotic thriller. And in it, men and women are having sex, and the sex was the thing that sets the plot in motion. And the genre lasted from about 1981 to about, I don't know, the late 90s, it was pretty much dead. Some of these movies include Body Double from 1984, the Brian De Palma movie, 9 1/2 Weeks from 1986 with Kim Basinger and Mickey Rourke. But the genre reaches its apex in 1987 with a movie that completely just electrifies the nation.
A look that led to an evening.
It's called Fatal Attraction.
A mistake he'd regret all his life.
And it stars Glenn Close and Michael Douglas as two people having a hot, sexy affair for the weekend while his wife is out of town. And Glenn Close doesn't like it when he decides he's going to go back to his family.
I've got
to
see you.
This is going to stop.
No, it's not going to stop. It's going to go on and on.
She keeps calling me apart. Hello.
It was a huge box office hit. Everybody was talking about this movie. It made Glenn Close a star. It cemented Michael Douglas as the kind of leading man that women just couldn't help but try to persecute with their sex. It also was one of those 80s movies that completely misrepresents what it's like for a woman to have a career. And it papers over the mental illness that's behind Glenn Close's behavior in the first place.
I guess you thought you'd get away with it. Well, you can't.
So, today on the show, we're going to talk about Fatal Attraction. There's a lot wrong with this movie, and yet, it's such a good movie. I'm Wesley Morris. I'm a culture writer at the New York Times. And this is Still Processing. Parul Sehgal, welcome to the show.
Hey, Wesley.
You're a staff writer at The New Yorker. And when you worked here at The New York Times, you and I sat next to each other for a long time.
First of all, I miss you, Wesley.
I miss you, too. We've had many conversations, and now I'm here to ask you about Fatal Attraction. You've spent some time with this movie. How did the time you spent with this movie make you feel?
Yeah, no, I mean, that's nicely put. I have spent some time with this movie, and this is one of the few movies my family owned. We owned The Ten Commandments, Singing in the Rain, Fatal Attraction, 3 or 4 bootleg Bollywood movies, and The Pink Panther. I watched it constantly, and every time I see this movie, I identify with a different character. I have a different sense of what this movie is about. I have a different sense of why this movie was thought to define the zeitgeist in the way it did. Mm-hmm. All of which is to say, I don't know what's going to come out of my mouth today, Wesley. I don't know.
Oh my God. Then you have come to the right conversation, my friend. This movie came out when I was 11 years old. I went to a boarding school in North Philadelphia. And for many of my afternoons on my town pass, is what we call them, I would go see Fatal Attraction. And I was so electrified by it. I just want to talk to you about everything in this movie.
Yeah.
So let's just start with the opening sequence, which is this panoramic shot of the Upper West Side. And you land in the apartment of this couple, the Gallaghers, Dan Gallagher and Beth Gallagher and their daughter, Ellen.
Daddy, telephone!
They're played by Michael Douglas and Ann Archer, and the actress playing the daughters, her name is also Ellen. And what you're watching is that this couple sort of basically get ready to go out for the evening.
She wants to know what you're wearing.
What's so striking is that they're all wearing the same thing. They're all wearing white shirts, billowing white shirts and underwear. And he's sitting on the couch and he's working. He's a lawyer.
Right.
It's clean. It's innocent. It's denuded of sex.
Uh-huh.
And so that's our introduction to the very, very hapless Dan Gallagher.
Oh, honey, honey, where's my blue suit?
It's on the back of the door.
Oh, shit.
They're on their way to going out for the evening.
Mm-hmm.
And they're going to a book party and they meet a woman.
Her name is Alex Forrest, and she's played by Glenn Close.
And she has this Medusa hair.
Mm-hmm.
And this Medusa gaze.
Medusa, witchy, wolfish. There's definitely a danger to this woman. So I think that makes her a little more attractive to Dan.
Can I get a champagne, please?
And then they meet up at the bar accidentally. He goes to get a drink, and she's right at his elbow. And they're at the bar. He turns to look at her. She looks at him, and she laughs.
My name is Dan Gallagher.
Alex Forrest.
Nice to meet you.
He's receptive. He's laughing. And she's in control, right? And then she sees his wife. And so, oh, is that your wife?
Mm-hmm.
You know, after this like tiny little moment of flirtation.
Mm-hmm.
And we can see automatically, you know, how much power she has in that moment.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the first meeting.
Right. And so the next scene is the wife going out of town.
Okay, see you tomorrow night.
But he has to stay in Manhattan to go to this meeting on a Saturday.
Dan, this is Alex Forrest, our new associate editor.
No, I met before. Hi.
Yeah, hello.
They smiley recognize each other.
Mm-hmm.
They're feeling each other out.
Yes.
And then, of course, they go out into the rain. And then there's this fabulously unsubtle moment. He's standing out in the rain and he can't open his umbrella. And, of course, she sails over to him and sort of rescues him gallantly.
Made in Taiwan.
Yeah, you'll need to stop the fight.
So they go to the restaurant. They're having, is it, it's dinner.
So they're at this restaurant and we can see again, you know, just she's in control. She's the one who sort of, you know, feeling him out a little bit, sort of toying with him in a very sort of feline kind of way, you know?
And you're here with a strange girl being a naughty boy.
I don't think having dinner with anybody's a crime.
Not yet.
I remember at the time and even now, there are a lot of pieces sort of trying to analyze Dan's blandness, his lack of appeal, like what's going on here? And maybe this is a really sad commentary on the state of heterosexuality, but what isn't, frankly? But there is a moment where you can see that he's somebody who can talk to women. He can talk to women. He will joke. He'll be quiet. He'll listen. He can make himself passive and sort of subservient.
Mm-hmm.
You know, especially in the beginning, we can see this is how he gets her trust a little bit, you know?
Oh, I definitely think it's going to be up to you.
We were attracted to each other at the party. That was obvious.
And then there's this moment that when I was 11 years old struck me as intensely erotic. He mouths something to her. Let's get the check. You can barely hear him say it. It's like his mouth is dry because he's terrified, right? This is another thing. He's scared of what's about to happen next, which is like what they call a smash cut, a hard cut. And they are in the apartment, in her apartment, doing it. I mean, they're going at it and it's a sex that you probably would not have seen people have before in a straight Hollywood movie that was, like, produced by Paramount. It's wild. It's violent.
It's a sex scene you wouldn't have seen then. And I don't know. For me, it's a sex scene you wouldn't see now. It's desperate. It's not romantic.
Mm-mm.
The camera is very, very close. You can almost smell them, it feels to me. Like she turns on the water at one point behind herself. She's on the sink and sort of like wets her neck and her chest. And then he's sort of carrying her towards the bed and penguin waddling in this funny way and almost falling over. So it's funny.
Yeah, because his pants are around his ankles. Yeah.
It's like they don't know they're being watched.
Yes.
And I think that there's something there that feels very honest to me about that scene.
This is something happening intimately between two people, but it is also something that is advancing the plot, right? Because, you know, one of the things about this genre is if you take the sex out of the plot, you don't have a plot. So all the sex they have in this movie needs to be had in order for you to feel the stakes of what winds up happening later.
And we also see them having sex in the elevator of her building, right?
Yeah.
You get the feeling that he's never had an affair, really. That's my feeling when I watch it. It's like you can see how how overwhelmed he is, how different everything is that's happening. So it's as far from the cozy Upper West Side apartment as can be.
What are you doing?
I gotta go.
So at the end of the weekend, he tries to leave.
He tries to leave, yeah.
And she's like, but I don't want you to go. Like, you know, this is, I don't like this.
I don't think I like this.
And then he sort of gives a rationale. I'd have more, and she says, I'd have more respect for you if you told me to fuck off. And he sits there and he thinks about it. And I don't, you know, again, kind of childish.
All right, then fuck off.
She kicks him out of the bed.
And you get out!
And he's clearly doing the math on the situation he's gotten himself into. And while he's in the other room, basically getting the rest of his things together, she comes and says, why don't you come say goodbye like a nice person? And he goes over and he gives her a kiss and they're kissing. And he realizes, he says, God, it's like your hands are wet.
My hands are all wet.
And he looks down at her hands. And this is the moment the movie changes, right? We're no longer in some steamy sex romp anymore. This isn't like two people having a weekend affair. This woman has slit her wrists and her hands are covered in blood.
Yeah, yeah. And in that little moment though, right? Like the hands are wet calls back to the sex on the sink. You can't help but notice she's wearing the same thing that the daughter was wearing in the first scene. Just that big white shirt, you know? So she looks so small, so innocent. And so then he immediately goes into caretaking mode, right? And we see him rushing around, bandaging her, and spends the night. And then he returns home. Sort of, you can tell, feeling like, I've bandaged it all up. It's all clean now.
Yes.
I've cleaned everything. I've left no traces, you know? And you can sense also a little bit of like, oh, you know, I handled that well. But it's not so simple.
Yes, it's not so simple because, you know, he's left his mark on this person. And basically, you know, the wife comes back.
Oh my God, I missed you.
And what you realize you've got here is a story of domestic disturbance, essentially.
Well, I should go away more often.
And it isn't just that the domesticity between these two people has been disturbed, but the actual sort of like the sanctity of the marriage, of the home, of the family is in question.
Hello.
Hi, honey. How you doing? The plumber come yet?
And then
it's Alex. Lewis.
Again.
Alex proceeds to stalk him.
Yeah, if she calls again, tell her I'm not here.
She calls his office. She calls his home.
Hello?
He doesn't want his wife, Beth, who's played by Ann Archer, to talk to Alex, so he changes the home number.
What am I supposed to do? You won't answer my calls. You change your number. I mean, I'm not going to be ignored, Dan.
And when Alex can't get him on the phone,
hi.
She shows up.
Hello.
At his office.
This isn't a bad time, is it? I was in the area. I figured that...
No, you want to come to my office?
And so, you know, he doesn't know what to do, and then she shows up in his house.
Alex Forrest.
Alex Forrest. This is my husband, Dan.
Alex has come over, quite ingeniously, to see about this home for sale. They're selling their apartment to move to Westchester. And Beth is just, you know, completely oblivious. Oh, you know, this is Alex.
And Beth is very sympathetic. She's like, oh, Alex, take our new number.
Yes.
You know, in case you want to reach us. This is where we're moving. She gives the name of the town, you know. And he can do
everything.
Is stand and watch. He cannot say anything.
I'll keep in touch. You're great.
And so sure enough, they move. But weird things keep happening. And they go one weekend to go see the in-laws, her parents, Beth's parents. They come home and the camera tracks across the living room to the front door and Beth Gallagher comes in and she just, you know, turns on a light, puts her purse down and looks into the kitchen and you just hear something, you hear a noise. Mm. There's a pot boiling on the stove. And there's a couple of cuts to the daughter running toward the cage where she keeps her pet rabbit. And the daughter reaches the cage at the same moment that Beth reaches the pot, pulls off the lid, and sees the rabbit.
Daddy!
What?
You know, so from that scene came like the phrase bunny boiler, you know,
mm-hmm.
for the unhinged woman, the potential unhinged woman in all women or some women.
Yes.
At one point, Michael Douglas says to the Glenn Close character, you know, you're sick. But that's about the most we get about what's going on with her. In general, it's treated as a morality issue, that there's something bad and evil about
yes.
this woman.
Yes.
And yes. it's one of the sort of lasting legacies of the movie, right? Because the movie doesn't really, you know, comment on what's going on, what caused this, what's behind this, mm-hmm. what's behind mm-hmm. her, mm-hmm. you know? Glenn Close did her own research and famously talked to psychologists and had her own narrative of what's behind this woman. And she, her theory was like, oh, this is a woman who was molested by her father, and that's why she's very, very troubled.
I also think that the movie's aware of the gender politics to up to a point, right? Mm. You know, Alex has a line where she goes, you know, you men, you think I'm just some cheap whore you can use and bang once and throw in the garbage.
Right.
That's not me. That's not what will be happening here. Yeah. And I think that the disposability, her refusal to be disposed of, is so important to her. But I also think it's crucial to this idea of the tension that's at work in this movie, which brings us to the ending in a way, because Alex shows up for a final time at the house. And the wife is taking a bath. Mm-hmm. She, you know, wipes the steam off with the sleeve of her robe. She looks, classic movie trick. There's Glenn Close, like some sort of ghost from the past. Alex Forrest has come into the home and is ready for her final assault.
What are you doing here?
She keeps saying, why don't you leave us alone? She speaks like the wounded wife. The wife right. now, she speaks to Ann Archer like she's the interloper. And of course, and again, in very Michael Douglas fashion, he's oblivious. And then hears the screams, rushes upstairs.
And the next cut is him flying into Alex Forrest. He throws her against the mirror. She slashes him. They wind up in the bathtub together. He tries to drown her. Great movie moment.
And one that comes from, you know, a great noir sort of trope too.
Yep.
She rises from the water. There's Ann Archer sort of like holding the gun and not looking triumphant, looking incredibly pained, incredibly wounded, incredibly on the verge of collapse herself. You know, really, it does come down to the women in that interaction.
The last shot of the movie is, you know, the door closes and, you know, we have the police have come and they've taken statements and presumably removed Alex Forrest from this domestic paradise. And as Dan and Beth close the door and embrace, the camera's not tracking toward them. It's moving toward a photograph of the three members of this family. It's not the family itself. It's this idea of family and this idea of domesticity and happiness. Mm-hmm. And there's something about that artificiality that just also feels like a judgment to me, right? Like nobody's right here. The only thing that's real is the sex
right.
and the violence.
Right. No, and in the same way that final lingering shot of the family in the frame, which just fills me with queasiness every single time. And
yeah,
you feel,
me too.
Right? Like, and you feel the violence required to maintain that family. The violence
uh-huh,
required
uh-huh.
to maintain,
yes,
as you
yes,
said,
yes.
the vision of that family.
Right.
And the borders of that family is something that the film, I think, is knowingly doing, you know?
Yeah. Like, I look at that shot and I'm like, well, I mean, there you have it. Welcome to America, everybody. Like, this is what's underneath this sort of pristine idea of white domestic bliss, right? All of the violence that has to be committed to keep it together. You're totally right about that.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm really struck by the way that it sort of uses whiteness as,
mm-hmm.
as a standard in a way that's, you know, not dissimilar from the way other movies function always. But there's something about the ownership of whiteness, both as a color and an experience here,
mm-hmm.
right?
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, like a kind of upper middle class, executive level, white collar whiteness, where there's always peril because nothing will ever be enough.
Well, there's always peril, but there's also always a way that sex and sexuality is the only way to invite danger.
Mm-hmm.
The way
mm-hmm,
that foreignness
mm-hmm,
and
yes.
otherness is used also in combination with sexuality is interesting and important. Mm-hmm. You know, it's at this particular restaurant for this Japanese book that he meets the woman.
Yes.
Then he goes salsa dancing with her at night. And it's always tinged with stepping out of whiteness into another world, into the other, that he's able to have these other, you know, experiences and of a certain kind of different sexuality. And I think, you know, much has been made of the fact that this genre really started to flourish during the AIDS epidemic, you know, and what does this mean when
absolutely
no sex is safe, but also a really interesting way of, you know, that the sort of triumph of the family, of the wife killing the other woman, the triumph of that Westchester home.
Yep. Well, what's interesting about this movie as an erotic thriller is that very question, right? Mm. We think about it as it pitting Michael Douglas against Glenn Close, but Michael Douglas actually is working for Ann Archer.
Michael Douglas can't open his umbrella. Okay.
Right.
He can't, he's shown that he can't get his own cab.
Right.
He can't say check please in an audible tone. Right. So all over the place, we're seeing him deliberately and in a way that's very self, you know, it exculpates him as, you know, I don't even know. I just stumbled into this. You know, I'm just this little lamb and it's really between my wife, this like powerful mother figure and this virago. And I'm just caught in the between. How convenient. How cozy for him.
Yes. Yes. We're going to take a break. And when we come back, why don't we talk about all the different ways in the last 35 years that this movie has been interpreted, reinterpreted, and misinterpreted? Well, Parle, I mean, I just want to come back to this idea that I didn't know how you felt about this movie before we got here today. It seems to have had an impact on you. And what is it about this movie and maybe the genre in general with respect to women that intrigues you?
First of all, I think that, at least for me, I don't have one stable point of identification. I will watch this movie and I will feel Michael Douglas's worry and terror and what it's like to have all the illicit unlock something that you then cannot control.
Mm-hmm.
I will watch it and I will see the way that Glenn Close's character is created as a way to sort of frighten anybody about having that kind of need.
Yeah.
You can identify with the child too, who's used in incredibly interesting ways, almost as another camera and sort of takes the whole scene and turns it on its head. So there's so many different points of identification, which makes it hard for me to think in terms that this movie is saying one particular thing about women.
Yeah.
And I also, you know, the real engine to getting this film made was a producer named Sherry Lansing.
Mm-hmm.
She'd had her own experience of sexual obsession, she said, and of sexual loneliness and rejection. And she just found it dark and interesting and complicated and shocking to her. And she wanted to see it.
Yeah.
And to the end, she continued defending Glenn Close's character, saying that this is somebody who I had empathy for. You know, this isn't somebody necessarily who I think that the film was setting out to punish. Now, it is more complicated because she is punished.
Yes, she sure is. She gets killed at the end. But, I mean, that wasn't the original ending. The ending we saw over and over as kids, that's a reshoot. And nobody in the cast, not Glenn Close, not Adrian Lyne, nobody wanted to do a different ending, but it tested well, so they did it.
So the original ending of the film, we see Glenn Close in her apartment kill herself.
Mm-hmm.
And she's framed Michael Douglas for her murder. And
and
he's narrowly, we get a sense that he will be saved because Ann Archer has found these tapes in which she's, you know, Glenn Close had recorded for Michael Douglas telling him she was going to do all these terrible things to herself, kill herself, etc. The ending was changed after it was tested. Producers said that audiences, and I'm going to quote one of the producers, he said that the audiences wanted, quote, the bitch to be killed with extreme prejudice. So it's very hard to have like one sense of what's being said and what's exactly is happening.
Yeah.
But tell me what you're thinking, Wesley, when it comes to women.
Well, I mean, there's a few things, right? This is the first decade where women are going to work in every movie. And Ann Archer is an old model of female character. She's a placeholder for some other idea of maternity, of womanhood. And so throughout the decade of the 80s, you have women in the workplace, you know, doing executive jobs. And their work, of course, becomes the centerpiece of the movie, right? Like whether or not they can handle the job and handle being the old style woman. How do we balance these two things?
Right. But then also like what it does to sexual dynamics. It's almost a question of like, yes, how can women sexually function if they're employed?
Right. Yes.
So Wesley, like we're seeing all the different kinds of things that this genre, which, you know, some people can laugh at, they can say it's trashy, it's this, that, the other. We can see all the things that this, a film like this can do. Why did these films go away?
Oh man. I think there's a number of things that could possibly explain the death of this genre. One of them is that the genre started to eat its own tail. I think 1998, this movie called Wild Things comes out, and the four people participating in this erotic thriller know they're in an erotic thriller, I would say. But I think there's something even more profound and relevant to what you and I are talking about today. That can explain what happened to the genre. And I think that's the Bill Clinton, Monica Lewinsky scandal. That also happened in 1998. And I think the idea that the sex we were watching in movies was also happening in the White House is kind of unpalatable for a lot of people. Like you no longer wanted to go watch Michael Douglas have sex with anybody because the way we think about power and the way we sort of conflate power with executive function in some way, the idea that this person that we've imbued with this idea of ultimate executive power had abused his power to have sex at work the way we've been watching people do in movies for 10 years was too much. And I think there is something about the reckoning that we were forced to do about Bill Clinton and Monica Lewinsky and the preservation of the family, because the same configuration of the Clintons is true for the Gallaghers, right? It's two married people and a daughter. And, you know, the conversation was all about, like, what message is this going to send to our children? What about Chelsea? Like, what about Hillary? Hillary is just, you know, how innocent is Hillary?
Right. I'm trying to think of, like, the next big wave of, like, where I next saw sexuality going in a pop culture way after the erotic thriller. And it was for me, I mean, correct me if I'm wrong, this is just what I remember. Really became the sort of babyish faux innocence of like the nymphet pop star who was sexual but didn't know it, you know, or was there was like a pretense of not really knowing what you're doing or what your effect is on other people.
Oops, I did it
exactly,
again.
Exactly. Oops, yes, I did it again, yes, right? Which is as far from Alex Forrest. It's like it's a separate species,
yes,
you know?
Yeah, it's a whole sexual reset that's at the beginning of the internet that we now have. Mm-hmm. At the beginning of this image-oriented era where you, unlike the 80s and 90s, you now have images with no narrative, images with no story. I mean, that's one explanation for what I think happened.
No, it's so true, because I think that one of the things that we've been talking about where erotic thrillers went as a genre, but there's also where did the erotic go, period, you know, and not just in film, but in fiction, for example. It's gone, you know, and it can be referenced. You can do it lightly. You can be superior to it.
Right.
And there's part of me that when I think about what I want sex in any medium to do, like I want there to be food in films. I want there to be human behavior in films. I want, as Roger Ebert once wrote beautifully, in praise of gratuitous nudity, you know, like you want it to not be instrumental in this particular way,
right,
not to have points to make sometimes. You know?
Right.
But for the challenge of depicting something that is really difficult to articulate, it does pose a very, very particular, interesting challenge to the artist, and you want to see how they will meet it and what they will do with it.
Yes. Yes. There's a lot of data that tells us that younger people especially are having less sex than younger people, you know, a decade before. Mm-hmm. That's attributable to a lot of things, but I think one of the things that I'm thinking about in terms of why that could be is because there aren't a lot of stories being told about sex. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of extra narrative, non-narrative sexual things happening, but there aren't a lot of places to see a story where if you remove the sex from it, you have no movie.
I think that that's exactly right. I think that we're seeing, like when it comes to sex, we see the hydraulics quite a bit, but we don't really see the story. We don't really see the stakes. We don't really see shock and surprise and need and all of these other sorts of really important ways that we need to sort of configure and to chart our own path.
Mm-hmm.
We see sex, if at all, often. We see it with younger people. We see it with teenagers. And I'm thinking of Euphoria.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, this might be a little out of left field, but...
Not here.
Okay, this is a safe space for this. So this is not even an erotic thriller, but when I think of something like Anna Karenina, right? Which is another great story of infidelity. So what is so moving and powerful about that particular story, I think, is it's not just that Anna Karenina is tempted by younger, dashing Vronsky and, you know, annihilates her own life.
Mm-hmm.
It's that the novel is also about custody. It's about her child. She is going to lose her child. And so when you look at it again, it's about sexual thrall, but it's also about all the things that you have to pay for that.
Mm-hmm.
And I think there's an easy way to sort of look at films and novels like this saying that, oh, you know, no good orgasm goes unpunished. But I think that they're also trying to say something really about what happens with sexuality, what happens with this incredible, it's incredible disheveling power.
Carl Sagal, I adore you. I can't believe that I got to spend this time talking to you. I can do it in real life, but to be able to do it here is an honor and a pleasure and a thrill.
Wesley Morris, anytime. Thank you so much.
That's our show. Still Processing is produced by Elissa Dudley and Hans Buto, edited by Sarah Saracen and Sasha Weiss. The show was mixed by Marion Lozano and recorded by Maddie Masiello. Digital production by Mahima Chablani, Des Ibiqua, and June O. And our theme music is by Kindness. It's called World Restart from the album Otherness. We're here next week. See you then.